Welcome to the Conestoga Podcast. This is Program 18 for November 7, 2006. Conestoga is Oklahoma's largest literary, science fiction, and fantasy convention. Conestoga 10 was held on July 28th through the 30th, 2006, here in Tulsa, Oklahoma. We celebrated our 10th anniversary with Yard Dog Press and Misha Marlin Publishing. Finally, our podcast with our guest of honor, David Drake. I chose to do this one a little differently. A fair number of science fiction writers have a military background. I thought it would be interesting to bring together two such writers to talk about writing and the military. I asked M.T. Wrighton, author and Conestoga regular, to sit down and have a conversation with David. So sit back and relax and listen as Matt and David discuss the similarities and differences in their experiences. This was recorded in front of a live audience, so you'll hear some noise in the background, and David does use a few strong words during the course of the conversation. I want to welcome you to the Conestoga Podcast. This is Chris Merle, your podcast host, and this afternoon I have our guest of honor, David Drake. He's an author author of more books than we have time to list, best known for his military SF, but also writes fantasy and space opera. His background includes a degree in law, and has worked in assistant town attorney in Chapel Hill, North Carolina, and he has also served in the Army and served in Vietnam.
And Cambodia.
Matt Wrighton.
It was a legal invasion.
And Matt Wrighton goes by the name M.T. Wrighton for his pen name, is a brand new author who has won the Phobos Award and the winner of Writers of the Future, and he is a newly minted Ph.D. in physics. Matt has also served in the Army and has had tours in both Bosnia and Afghanistan. I want to thank you both for joining me here today.
Thank you, Chris.
We're very pleased to be here.
And I thought, because we have two generations of writers here that have both served in the military.
God, you're making me feel old. Quite deservedly, I am old. But.
I thought it would be nice to have a discussion because, you know, in science fiction, there are a lot of writers that have a background in the military. You know, Heinlein, of course, he didn't serve in World War II, but, you know, he got out on a medical discharge, and even Asimov served in, and some were officers like Keith Lahmer, Jerry Pournelle, and of course the list goes on, and some were enlisted as well, like Harry Harrison. But I guess probably is, where should we start? Matt, do you have any questions you want to start with?
Well, for example, Joe Haldeman has been working on a literary therapy program almost, with returning vets to write about their experiences in whatever form that they're most comfortable with.
Yep.
What is your view on this?
I think that's an absolutely wonderful idea. I came up with it for myself without knowing what I was doing. But that's exactly right. When people write me at the website, which happens fairly frequently, saying they're having problems, and which, as I say, happens fairly frequently, I advise them to just write it down. You're not writing it for anybody. It doesn't matter if anybody else sees it. Quite frankly, they're not going to understand it even if they do read it, unless there are other people who've been there. But the process of writing it down is really, really important, and I think the fact there is a formal program to do that is hugely beneficial.
You know, this is also going to be touching back on some of the things I've heard you say in various panels throughout the con so far, and one of them was talking about speculative fiction being a reflection on the society in which it was written.
Yes.
However, I would contend that the mirror isn't flat. There's a lot of extrapolative, sometimes to absurdity levels that go along with this. So are the military science fiction pieces that have been written, were they cautionary tales? Were they a reflection of the man, the boots on the ground? Or is it people actually trying to say, this is what warfare is going to be like someday?
I don't think the veterans, any that I can think of, that would certainly include people like Harry Harrison and Joe Haldeman, and me, and Jerry Pournelle, just trying to think of people. Gene Wolfe. We're talking about people who had an honest-to-God combat experience. People don't think of Gene Wolfe that way, but he very much was in the shooting part of the Korean War, just as Jerry was. I can't think of any of the people who've actually been there who are trying to write attempts to seriously extrapolate the future. Can you? I mean, would you give any examples of people who were?
If that was the intent to go through and say, this is what's going to happen next, probably not. But that doesn't mean that things aren't happening as they were written to a certain extent. Consider the current situation in Iraq, where mercenaries, corporations, who wrote something about that?
Yeah, well, I didn't make any of it up. I mean, you know, Air America was doing quite a lot of what was being done in Vietnam was not being done by people who were in uniform like me. The mercenaries tended to be locals who were being trained by civilians, generally civilians with a military background, but civilians under CIA pay, rather than formed mercenary units being brought in to do the fighting. We're getting into more of that in Afghanistan and Iraq, partly because I think we don't have a draft. And in order to keep casualties down, it's easier to find money than it is to find men whom you can afford to lose. That was not a problem that LBJ and Robert Strange McNamara ever had, because they had the draft to pump it. But I was not attempting to be... I picked a mercenary unit, quite frankly, because that's what the Kuttners had done, Clash by Night and Fury. And it seemed simplest to go there. I wasn't modeling it on Jerry Pournelle, but Jerry had done the same thing.
The Janissaries?
Yeah. Actually, and before that, the West of Honor, and the Mercenary itself. I wasn't attempting to be predictive. I wasn't attempting to be predictive when I did the intercommunications among the vehicles and vehicles to command. That was just something that would have made things a hell of a lot easier when I was there riding a tank. And it wasn't so much extrapolation, we're going to have this. It's just, it would have been so much better if we'd had this. And I stuck it in that ground. Well,
now that's exactly what they have, down to pinpointing locations on battlefields, complete communication between platoons up to company, up to brigade.
Right. And you can even get absurdities like the decision to abort the Desert One landing in Iran being made by Jimmy Carter speaking to the force commander on the ground in the desert in Iraq. I mean, that was absurd.
Well, you brought up a very good point, and in fact ties into one of the questions that I was thinking about, looking more on the predictive aspect. And there was a war that commanders were complaining about new communication systems, technologies, letting politicians and generals far, far away from the battle actually micromanage troops.
Yep.
And, of course, that was the Crimean War, and the technology was the telegraph. So is this a new problem?
No, but it's an inevitable one, unless... it's funny. What you really need is a commander-in-chief who refuses to do that. And the best example of that being, you know, somebody who did it exactly right was Mrs. Thatcher. In the Falklands campaign, she knew absolutely nothing about the military. She was a grocer's daughter. Still is a grocer's daughter. And she, after the Argentinians invaded on the assumption that Britain is now ruled by a woman who, you know, doesn't have any balls. Boy.
There's a song I can tell you about later.
Yeah. Thatcher's.
But she went to her staff and said, can we take back the Falklands? Because this is a hell of a long way away. And what they told her was, yes, if we put everything we've got into it. She said, go do it. And kept out from that point. This is something very few male commanders-in-chief would have the courage to do. I mean, Jimmy Carter, who was a horrible president, but a very good man, was not able to keep out of it.
And a naval officer.
And a naval officer. Yes, he actually had training. McNamara and LBJ were planning bomb runs by the tail numbers of the individual aircraft. They were assigning targets personally by individual aircraft. The degree to which this is playing soldiers by people who were utterly incompetent is horrifying. And that was the reality that I was in. The technology is going to make it easier to interfere. We need really more training at the upper levels to keep the people at the upper levels from getting in the way of the soldiers. And because, you know, frankly, if you're a colonel and the president gives you an order, you'd better say, how high, sir?
Absolutely.
That's the only proper answer for him to make. So you cannot train the military so that they will resist political interference, because, no, that's not how the system works.
It's not supposed to be a political arm.
Exactly.
And I saw the same thing in Bosnia, where two-star generals are watching on live TV what a platoon leader is doing on the ground.
Mm-hmm.
And it's with the thing of, well, there could be international impact if he screws up. Of course,
sure.
He's a 22-year-old kid with a rifle and a bunch of guys who want to shoot something.
Yep. Yep.
And along those same lines, you've probably heard this particular phrase before. You can be replaced.
Yes, I have.
And this is one big change, looking at the smaller, lighter, more mobile, more budget-conscious military. How important is individual character now to events that occur on the battlefield if you start having the technological link from the very top all the way down to the guy pulling the trigger? And are we actually at a point where we could say people are replaceable?
Absolutely not. Absolutely not. The sort of people who tend to think that, they're not necessarily non-military. Donald Rumsfeld, in fact, did have a background in naval aviation. It wasn't combat, but frankly, it wouldn't really have mattered if it had been. The assumption you can do it all with technology, with precision weapons and surgical strikes, this is something that just bothers me every time I hear the word. You're dropping a 2,000-pound bomb. That is not surgery. Even if it lands exactly where you want it to land, that is not surgery. Collateral damage is a reality, and it means there are body parts of civilians all over, and that's just how it happens. It's going to happen. And it has to happen sometimes, but don't pretend it doesn't happen. It's worth noting that the thing that really broke the Iraqis in was when an armored unit made a thunder run to the Baghdad airport and then drove through Baghdad. The whole concept of the thunder run was one that the Black Horse originated in Vietnam. And let me tell you, we weren't running through major cities full of hostiles. I mean, I got the greatest respect for the people who did that work. And bombing won't do that. Running tanks through their backyard does do it. We've got the facts on that one. Destroying vehicles from the air, a lot of times you don't even know they're destroyed, and they you know, killed by air was kind of a joke in Vietnam, because depending on the unit, he's still standing up, so put another two rounds into him, and we'll call it another two bodies, because they're trying to get the body counts up. We had two different terms. There's, you know, killed by air, but then there was stepped on. And stepped on meant just that.
Well, I mean, you do bring up another thing. A comment you made earlier is, we're probably not going to be fighting another conventional war. And that does reflect back in maybe perhaps the only place we will see conventional wars, large naval engagements and major land battles, will be in science fiction. So at this point, when it turns into this extrapolative approach to writing science fiction, asymmetric warfare isn't new. But there is a huge influx of technology that allows it to be much more effective. And you've also written about mixing low and high tech, very low and ultra high tech. And I saw a lot of that actually in Afghanistan, where you have the 1300s, except for Pepsi, Toyota trucks, and AK-47s.
Mm-hmm.
So
mm-hmm.
What do you think about the impact of that, that the changing paradigm of warfare on science fiction, to be specific, and on the world in a more broader sense?
In science fiction, I don't know that it's going to have much of an effect, because except for the people who've been there, you know, folks reading about it really don't understand what it's really like. And it wasn't a whole lot different in Vietnam. You know, not nearly as different as the impression one would get. The Arvins were not competent with heavy weapons. They were dangerously incompetent with heavy weapons.
Similar situations are arising.
Oh, I bet your ass, yes. The other side, which is almost entirely NVA by the time I was there in 1970, so it was almost entirely NVA, not VC, didn't have heavy weapons. I mean, you were talking about Katyusha rockets launched very frequently on a long fuse, maybe mortars. There were people, especially in the north, especially later, who were running into serious anti-aircraft weapons, even SAM-2s. But that was really very much the exception. So far as we were concerned, it was people with AK-47s and RPGs, which there were B-40s and B-41s, which was the Chinese designator. The B-40 was the RPG-2. The RPG-7, which is now omnipresent and is a very, very effective weapon, the B-41, was not commonly met, and that was a damn good thing. A B-41 would go through an M-48 tank much of the way out the other side, and that includes if there was somebody in the way, which sometimes there was.
But Sheridans weren't.
Oh, Sheridans were a death trap.
Yeah.
Sheridan, I mean, Jesus, I'm talking about real tanks.
Right, okay.
God. Hey, the first Sheridan I saw had been dragged back into the fire base when I landed. And they had steel turrets and aluminum hulls.
Mm-hmm.
And
that's so you could drop them out of airplanes.
That was the theory. And that actually is true. After they started running them in Vietnam for a while, they put belly plates on them, and they could no longer be dropped out of airplanes. But then we weren't dropping them out of airplanes, and that didn't make them tanks either. But the first one I saw had driven over a mine, and they had caseless ammunition. This, later on, they put a plastic case around a stub case. But you actually had bare powder, and you fired it, and you didn't eject anything from the breech. It all burned up. Well, I tell you, you roll over a 20-pound mine, and it blows through the bottom of the fighting compartment, and you know that caseless ammunition all goes off and burns. And so the steel turret had sunk down between the treads. That was the first Sheridan I saw. I didn't ride Sheridans. I rode AKEVs and I rode M48s, and I never rode a Sheridan. And that was a decision I was capable of making, and not everybody was.
www.balticonpodcast.org.
Let the Balticon Podcast take you inside the minds of the people who make science fiction happen. Get the scoop on what's happening in science fiction from authors, techies, and scientists. We guarantee that you'll be entertained and enlightened.
The Balticon Podcast. Great interviews with the people who make science fiction happen. Authors, fans, and honest-to-God scientists. And we play music at the end. Search for Balticon in iTunes or visit us at www.balticonpodcast.org.
And now back to our conversation with author M.T. Ryden and our author guest of honor, David Drake.
So at this point, you'd say it'll be mostly revisiting major land battles of history, extrapolated into the future.
But, you know, it's not just...
Or Horatio Hornblower. And
exactly. Or in my case, Patrick O'Brien. But, yes, that's exactly right. But it's not just the fiction. I was horrified at the beginning of the very successful invasion of Iraq. And you have convoys running into, you know, militia and getting the hell shot out of them because, A, they're lost, and, B, they don't have any escort. Nobody who served in Vietnam was unaware of how to escort a convoy. I mean, that was just a given. You did not send trucks or a maintenance unit.
Well, definitely by 1970. But earlier on, the Transportation Corps did have to make do with their gun trucks and guys welding plates on the side.
Absolutely. And you know, I saw some of the Quad 50 gun trucks. No, I'm not. But the thing is, we had learned that by 1970. And they had then forgotten it by 2000. You know, it's not just science fiction doesn't learn. And if it were just science... My wife's nephew is in the Iowa National Guard. He was a lieutenant colonel, and I happened to look at the this was a couple of years ago, and I happened to look at the little training book that he would have to know if he were to go up for colonel, which he was half thinking of doing. And it's questions about what is the role of the presidential security advisor and how does this differ from the secretary of state and this sort of thing. Christ, what a lieutenant colonel ought to know about is how to organize a convoy. I mean, you know, that's what a battalion commander needs to know to do. And they're being asked policy questions where the proper answer is, sir, this is none of my business, sir. And the Army is training people to ignore their real jobs and to focus on things that are none of their business. And this deeply disturbed me.
The role of the staff is to write those books.
Well, I would like
and they create their own.
Yes.
I would like to interject one comment here. At least David's and Matt's fiction doesn't get people killed.
That's absolutely
I try and make it really, really clear. I've had people who told me they joined the military because they really liked my fiction, and I think, okay.
Did you miss the body parts section? Are you serious about the duty? What really did it? Is it just the romance? That's something that's a good question, actually.
Well, I thought about it. My first thought was utter horror. Because, look, I was a draftee. And, okay, I went. There were options. I went, you know, fine. But I'm a citizen of the United States. They had a right to send me. I went. It wasn't really a question. I didn't think it was a good idea. But I did not have a good time. And I'll tell the world, it fucked me up good. And I didn't. Look, I say I didn't have a good time, and I didn't. But I came home with all my pieces. Nothing bad happened to me. And I
say that. Sometimes feel guilty saying that? Because my experience, both Bosnia and Afghanistan, things happened where I wasn't. And sometimes it's like, do I have the credibility to talk about this?
Well, and then I get back, and nobody else has been there, because I came back to Duke Law School.
Mm.
And I don't mean I had a bad time. I don't mean people treated me badly at Duke Law School. Nobody cared. I mean, you know, Duke Law School was not, trust me, a hotbed of political dissent, at least after the draft lottery came in and people knew they were safe. Nobody treated me badly. They were there to make money. And, you know, they weren't going to give me a hard time because I was a veteran. But nobody, I couldn't talk to anybody about it. Even if I used the words, they didn't know what the words meant. And you're probably running into that. It's as though I were writing stuff in Chinese. And with the best will in the world, they couldn't read Chinese. And I kept writing.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I kept writing. And as a result, I got contact from a lot of other veterans who'd been there. And that includes World War II and Korean War. And I realized that by reading my stuff, they realized they weren't alone. And that's because you feel really alone. And yeah, I mean, I had a family. I had friends. It's not, you know, I wasn't really alone. But there was nobody else who'd experienced what I experienced, which is utter bullshit. But they weren't in my circle, and they aren't in most people's circle, unless you stay in the Army,
mm-hmm.
which I had no intention of doing. Amen to that. Told by friends who were intended to be career military that the mid-70s were not the time to stay in the Army.
That was a very bad time. There was a rift. My father had intended to make a career out of it with the 509th Airborne Mechanized.
Yeah. That's just a joke. Yes, I know. I understand.
They can drop them once. And,
exactly. And whether they can drive them off when they've... Yeah. Oh, the Sheridan was such a bad idea. M551 Sheridan is just awful, awful, awful.
Interesting idea, but
yes.
Poor in execution. But then there's a reduction in force in, mm-hmm. in 73. Boom. Okay, everybody out.
Was he a major?
Captain who had a run-in with someone at one point.
That's all it took. Yeah.
And then you also mentioned earlier at this con, about the reduction in force after the fall of the Soviet Union, 1991.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And
mm-hmm. We don't need troops anymore. We're going to do it all with high tech. And anyway, there's no enemy.
And one thing I can speak of in the 90s, they were desperate to get lieutenants and captains because they got rid of them all. But
and you would be amazed at the casualty rate among lieutenants and captains, especially when they don't know their job.
That's absolutely true. But to bring it back to science fiction, you said we got rid of a million people that were a potential market for
yes.
military science fiction.
Yes, they were.
Do you think that is true, that the readers of military science fiction are those who have military experience or those that romanticize the military experience?
I think a very large... Okay.
And I'm not trying to get you in trouble with your readership.
No, not at all. And look, I'll give an honest question to anything. I'll give an honest answer to any question I'm asked. I think the readership for military science fiction is people who are interested in the military. I think people, especially in a volunteer army, are by definition interested in the military. And I think by definition then, by reducing the number, the other aspect of that is that most of the time a soldier has a lot of time on his hands. And so you have potential readers with an interest in the subject who are likely to have a considerable block of time on their hands. I know when I was in Vietnam, I taught myself French from a teach yourself book, not because I had any burning need to learn French, but it was something to do that kept my mind active. And I honestly did. I was reading Molière, by myself, self-taught. Yeah, I'm good at languages, but, you know, this it was simply a friend had gotten the Teach Yourself books, and he wasn't using them, so I borrowed them.
That you actually brought up something, and this is just talking about the current military, an all-volunteer military compared to a draft military, and that is there's a different cross-section of the nation mm-hmm. that is now involved in the military
mm-hmm.
Than just randomly picking people out.
Mm-hmm.
And I found the reason I left active duty was it was fairly anti-intellectual. Somebody who was busy teaching themselves French would be ostracized, actually. What's up with that guy? Did you see that at all?
Not especially, but a very special thing happened. I was drafted in 1969. In 1968, LBJ and his toady, Robert Strange McNamara, deeply hate that man. Hate them both, but particularly McNamara.
Have you danced on any graves?
Not yet.
Okay, just checking.
Let the bastard die, and I'm well, going to see if I can get to Martha's Vineyard.
Okay.
They did away with the graduate student deferment.
Hmm.
Now, the next year, the draft lottery came in. But what that meant was that for a year, everybody who had graduated from college was draftable. So my basic training influx was about a third black kids from inner city Detroit, about a third kids from the mountains of North Carolina, same level of intellectual endeavor, but they were mountain kids, whites. And the other third were college graduates. That much. One of the guys in my squad was in a master's, it was in a PhD program in physics at the University of Chicago. Another of the guys I was in with was getting his PhD in Old English at Princeton. I was in the middle of Duke Law School. And this was absolutely typical of the time I went in. Now, if it had been me and just the kids from Detroit and the kids from Buncombe County, that would have been different.
Mm. Well, personally, I got a fair rash of crap from my drill sergeants when they found out that I had a master's degree in applied physics and I had enlisted. And it was one of these things, what the hell are you doing here, son?
Oddly enough, my drill sergeants were really very supportive. Part of the thing was, guy in my squad, Mike Glass, who was the physics grad, and I were both extremely... We worked our butts off. You know, we were not given any rank, and we shouldn't have been given any rank. But we were both regarded as... We were not only doing the best we could, but we were doing pretty goddamn well. I was one target short of having the battalion record at the range. I was 497 out of a potential 500 on the PT test, and what that meant was that I'd run the mile in 6 minutes and 23 seconds instead of 6 minutes and 13 seconds. And if that doesn't sound very good, remember it's wearing fatigues and combat boots.
Not good. Not good.
But that is an impressive record.
That's an impressive record. Yeah. Not good running in.
Oh, no, no. That was a terror. They don't do any of the things
my dad's
used to
knees
do.
Are blown.
Yes,
nowadays.
Yes, exactly. Exactly. And the drill sergeants were really very positive toward us because we were trying and we were actually going to be good soldiers for the 2 years the bastards had us. So I didn't run into that there.
Oh, well, I mostly just kept my mouth shut and did what I was told, and they loved me for that.
Yes.
Especially in the all-volunteer army. But
yeah, the fact you could read probably put you ahead. Yeah.
To a certain extent.
Well, I'd like to ask one final question of both of you, and this is actually going to—I want Matt to answer first. In the time that you were in Afghanistan, I remember you telling me a story about one particular Afghani officer that you had the utmost respect for, was there one particular person that had stood out while you served over there? And that's kind of a general question towards David.
So. In Afghanistan, or yeah. talking U.S. military, or just anyone,
actually it was an Afghan.
The sergeant. When I went to Afghanistan, I was training the Afghan National Army, not the whole army. In fact, just a brigade. In fact, not the whole brigade, just the communications officer for the brigade. And the first gentleman that I had a chance to work with, he was trained by the Soviets. And he was an XO from a commando brigade, and he was just doing this, but he was sharp, he was on the ball, he was honest, which was very difficult to come across. He's somebody that you could build a new fledgling Western-style army upon. Of course, he was replaced shortly later by someone who I will refer to as a punk weasel. And he was there just to get as much out of us as possible in the very Afghan approach of fairly mercantile business. You don't have anything to grow, so people pass through and you get stuff from them. But the sergeant major, even though I talked about the first signal officer, very good, but the sergeant major was excellent. He believed in things, and he'd worked with the Mujahideen and had the Northern Alliance. And so you have all these people from different places smushed together and trying to forge a working military. With no common language, pretty much, except for Dari, which is the trade language, so everybody spoke a little bit of the Afghan Persian. However, he was too honest, and if you're too honest, they either demote you or promote you to the point where you are ineffective. And that's what I saw happen. So while the time I was there, there was, actual good things happening. But things have gone south since I left. Not taking that as a personal statement, just of how history has flowed.
David, is there any particular soldier that you served with in Vietnam that you had developed the utmost respect for?
Grail Brookshire. Lieutenant Colonel at the time, he was in command of the 2nd Squadron, which was during the invasion of Cambodia, and he left, he was rotated out not long thereafter. I happened to read later SLA Marshall's Six Battles in Vietnam or something like that. He had been the G2 of 2nd Squadron earlier and was responsible for blowing an NVA ambush on the site. One of the battles that Brookshire covered was actually an 11th Cav action, and Brookshire had been there at a lower rank and had been instrumental in that. Everybody respected him. Battle Six. He was personally brave, but that's not hard to find. He was smart. He led.
That's hard to find sometimes.
Yeah. Oh, it's really hard to find. And he wasn't a glory hog. He was one of Don Starry's proteges. Starry was the colonel at the time who, by grandstanding, got a bunch of shrapnel in his dick.
Irony!
Oh,
literally.
Yeah, literally. Yeah, it was funny. They dusted him off to Japan, and they flew his wife in to him. We just thought that was the funniest goddamn thing we'd ever heard. And they never named a firebase. There wasn't a firebase Starry. There had been a firebase Burkett over 2nd Squadron's sergeant major who'd lost his arm at Fort Defiance. The next firebase they named Firebase Burkett, but in the field we all called it Burkett's arm. And so they did not name a firebase Starry because I suspect they knew it was going to be Don's dick. But he apparently ended his career when, as IG, he inspected the corps Starry was commanding in Germany and gave an honest assessment of it. And Starry got him run out of the army as a result, which I regret. But yes, there was one man.
Okay. Well, I want to thank both David and Matt for their wonderful conversation, and hopefully we'll look forward to seeing both of you at future conventions.
Thank you for having us.
Thank you.
I hope this conversation gave you a better insight into the minds of writers who have served in the military. David brought up an interesting point that military SF is often a reflection of the world we live in. This is often true of non-military SF as well. SF often deals with characters using technology and its consequences, and nowhere is the use and misuse of it are more critical than in wartime, and that through it all we still have the same brains our hunter-gatherer ancestors did 10,000 years ago. Who can say what the future will bring? Let us hope that it brings us with the continued freedom to be able to walk into any bookstore or library we choose, and the freedom to pick up any books that interest us, and the freedom to read them. And let us hope the sacrifices made by our men and women who serve are not in vain. We have the responsibility as citizens to take care of our veterans in their time of need as they have taken care of us in ours. Well, enough with my spiel. I recently read David Drake's anthology, Grimmer Than Hell, and if you're looking for some of David's short fiction, I highly recommend it. And if you want to check out David Drake's most recent books, you can read Some Golden Harbor, Book 5 in the Saga of RCN Lieutenant Leary, or The Fortress of Glass, the first volume of The Crown of the Isles, in the Lord of the Isles universe. And be sure to check out Matt's story, Larry and Joe Bob Do Ask Krakistan, in International House of Bubbas by Yard Dog Press. I know a fair number of new writers, and I don't say this lightly, but I think M.T. Wrighton is a writer to watch for. It's still a little early to be, say, looking forward to seeing you all at Conestoga 11, so thanks for listening until our next Conestoga podcast. For more information, our web address is www.sftulsa.org, or send an email to conestoga@sftulsa.org. Questions about our podcast may be sent to podcast@sftulsa.org, so please send us an email or put a comment on the website and let us know what you thought of this podcast.